Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, you might not think this is the moment to tell employees that you can write your own rules for success, especially if you come from a struggling field like journalism, but that's just what two leading network journalists do in a brand new book called Womenomics, Write Your Own Rules for Success. ABC senior national correspondent Claire Shipman and BBC Washington correspondent for World News America, Katty Kay, argue that women, especially mothers, often want different things from the workplace than men and should demand their right to those things. They say demographic change in the workplace means employers will have to start accommodating women's work preferences more in order to succeed, recession or no. So let's find out more. And hopefully we'll also talk about some other news. They're critiquing Newsweek's Oprah cover and what they see as paternalistic autism coverage. Claire Shipman is on the Sotomayor nomination these days, had a piece this morning, and more. So Claire Shipman and Katty Kay, congratulations on the book and welcome to WNYC.
Brian, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, we're thrilled. Thank you.
Now, you write in the introduction that smart employers realize there is an asset to estrogen ratio in most workplaces these days. Who wants it? Did you make up that phrase?
Yes.
I think that was Katty's.
I think that we also made up the term pink profits, which is the same sort of thing. What we discovered, we started out writing this book thinking that this was going to be Claire and I's story of how we have personally struggled with and managed to find balance in our professional and private and family lives. And then as we started doing the research, we found that there was this huge trend really going on in the workplace, which really favors women. And one of the things that's driving that is the discovery of how valuable women are to businesses and to the economy, that companies that employ more senior women make more money. Now, if you are a woman wondering whether you can kind of negotiate for the kind of work-life balance you know you really need, just knowing that you have that power is incredibly valuable.
What's the evidence for that, and what would the reasons be?
Well, there are a number of studies. One of them was run by Pepperdine University over 20 years, and they looked at Fortune 500 companies. Catalyst has done a similar one. The University of California at Davis also found very similar things. And they don't know whether the reason is that the women there are making all of the smart decisions or that the companies who are bringing in this diverse group of voices are simply smart companies, and this is one bit of evidence that they're wise. But it's happened enough times that a lot of people notice that having women seems to make a difference to the bottom line, and people are paying attention to it. I don't know if you've also seen, Brian, there's been a lot of talk, especially in this recession, about the fact that women really do manage differently. Women have different management skills, different management styles. It's suddenly okay to admit it. We're different. The things that people thought years ago were soft are now really in demand in the 21st century workplace.
Like what? Give me an example of what
we
those
We collaborate management more easily. We try to conciliate as opposed to compete. We have an easier time negotiating. We bring people in. We nurture people. We bring them up. You know, things, again, it just seems like, you know, useful for a play group. And guess what? Useful for the boardroom.
And in this particular climate, the other kind of skills that women have, I think, that are particularly valuable are that we are more risk averse, and that we make decisions with a longer lead time. So we're looking 10 years down the track for our companies rather than perhaps just 10 weeks down the track, or perhaps even 10 minutes down the track if you're a bond trader making that trade where you're over-leveraging your company. So those kind of perhaps more cautious management skills, people are starting to say in this particular environment, are making companies more attractive if they have more women in them.
That's interesting. Why would women be more risk-averse, do you think?
You know, testosterone. I'm not kidding.
It is that Y chromosome.
A lot of the studies that they look out now, you know, the differences between men and women, they're breaking it down into science, and it has a lot to do with biology and hormones. And there was a fascinating study. Nick Kristof wrote an article on this, a piece, and quoted a study out of London that showed that the more money bond traders made happened on days when they had higher levels of testosterone in their system. They were taking more risk when they were feeling the testosterone in their bodies. And there's just something different about what goes on chemically.
Listeners, We're going to open up the phones on this
one. I know, exactly. I think we're going to get a few calls.
Are men and women leaders, managers, different at your workplace? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you're a top employer and you have employed both male and female managers, in your experience, is there an asset to estrogen ratio? Are there pink profits? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for Claire Shipman from ABC and Katty Kay from the BBC, author now of Womenomics, Write Your Own Rules for Success. You know, to follow up on that, there are different camps of feminism historically. And this book and the argument you were just making seem to fall into sort of the Carol Gilligan difference feminism camp, if you know what that is. Difference feminism argues that women aren't just equal to men, but different and sometimes superior as a group, that, you know, previously devalued feminine characteristics such as emotionality and social connectedness are actually better than stereotypically male traits like aggression and rationality. Women's tendencies, they argue, make for better workers and better human beings. Are you familiar with Carol Gilligan and the term difference feminism? Is that where you're at?
Well, there is something in that, that we are different. And I think for the last 30 years, women in the workplace have almost tried to say we're not different, and that when women first entered the workplace in the 1960s, they had to pretend that they were just like men. They worked those 60-hour weeks. They climbed that career ladder. They kind of kept the photographs of their children hidden in their purses. They didn't even want to mention that they had kids or that they wanted work-life balance because that somehow suggested that they were unambitious. And what we've found now is that women are finally able to say, we are different, and the needs that we have from the workplace are different. Women tend to want to see their careers, we think, more as a wave, where sometimes you dial up and sometimes you dial it back down again. But what we want to avoid is that awful crunch where women are opting out of the workplace altogether because, frankly, the economy can't afford to have us go. They cannot. Businesses can't afford the brain drain of professional, educated women. And we have more degrees. We have more postgraduate degrees. We have huge power as consumers. We even buy more cars than you guys do. I hate to say this, Brian, but we now have broken through that halfway mark, too. And the workplace needs us. So what we want to avoid is that brain drain. And you just have to, for that to be avoided, we've got to change the way the workplace looks.
But do you risk some blowback, Claire, for that argument? If employers start seeing women as a group on the mommy track, on the wave, instead of the straight line up, wanting less responsibility, some people will argue that this is why women haven't broken the glass ceiling yet in upper management, because they make different life choices that move them more away from work.
Yes, and it's a great argument. We love this argument. In fact, we were getting into it a little bit on our blog on womenomics.com, so you can see that some people are saying, look, we got to keep our eye on the prize here. But what we're saying is not opt out. We're not saying women should just quit the workforce. What we're saying is we need to make the workforce reflect our needs. We finally have the power to do that. Will it take a little bit longer to, you know, look, it took Brenda Barnes an extra 7 years to become CEO of Sara Lee since she quit. She's only one example, granted, but it's nice to have one out there, and she's making a lot of changes. So and the other reason I think that what we're talking about is it's a new feminism. It's the next step. I mean, look at what Michelle Obama has done. She represents exactly what so many women of our generation are looking at right now. She dialed back her career, this brilliant Harvard-educated lawyer. I mean, and I'm talking long before she got to the White House, to spend more time with her kids. Women want to do this, and they're going to do it. So it's a matter of figuring out how to keep us in the workforce. But here's the really interesting piece. The men of Gen Y sound much more like women. What they want is very similar to what the women of their generation want and what the women of the baby boom generation want. And so this is not going to be about men and women in 15 years. This is going to be about the way people in general want to work.
But the part of the research that we found that was really exciting is that we thought we can't just talk to women about this. We wanted to talk to companies too, because this has to work for companies. If this is going to be a major shift, a big revolution, as we believe it is, it has to be something that makes business sense for companies. And we went to companies all over America, companies you wouldn't really expect, Capital One, Best Buy, Marriott Hotels. And those companies that have kind of taken the clock off the wall and said to men and women, you can work the way you want. We will measure you based on your results, on how you perform, and not how many hours you're sitting at that damn cubicle over there. And those companies have actually found that productivity rises by something like 40%. Now, that means you can make a business case. This is not a favor being handed out like candy at a kid's birthday party anymore. This is a sound business strategy.
Listeners, are men and women in leadership positions different at your workplace? And anything else you want to react to from Katie Kay and Claire Shipman, authors of Womenomics, 212-433-WNYC, and Moti on Long Island. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
Women are detail-oriented. Like, if you give a woman an album of a wedding, they will go through every single picture, what a woman is wearing, how, you know, how their eyes look. Men will look through the album in 2 seconds. So the whole thing is you need, in a job, you need detail-oriented and not detail-oriented. You really need women in every single aspect.
Moti, you know what? You're dead on, because we're not arguing in this book that we want all companies to be run by women at all. What you need is the balance, because we have different skills. And it's, I think, the companies that are making more women because they have more women in senior positions are finding that it's opening the door to that big range of talent and having women come in as well as the men. And it's the kind of, like you say, it's that those two complementary skills that are driving this new trend that we're seeing, where if you have more women and more men, you're the company that's going to succeed. It's, and any company that ignores that is going to be in peril in the future.
It's the diversity. And it was funny, though, because we don't, you know, Charlie Rose, when we talked to him, was really fixated on the idea we were trying to say women are better than men, you know, and hey, men are good too. We could be good listeners, and we're not. Men bring a lot to the table too. Let us say it right here.
There's a little hint of that in the introduction too, but you know, it's almost, the Sonia Sotomayor, you know, rich Latina diversity experience, better decisions.
But you know what it is? It's that I think that women haven't realized how valuable they are. And that's why we wanted to write the book and present the business case, because women feel they aren't empowered to ask for the kind of work life that they need in order to stay in the marketplace. And that's why we called the book Womenomics. That's why we wrote about women, because women sometimes feel nervous about their positions. And if only they knew how valuable they are, then they can start to change their lives.
Lammy in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, Lammy.
Hi. I have a different perspective, and mainly this is from a small business perspective. We don't have a cubicle farm, but it's a small office. And please drop the estrogen testosterone thing, because it's bad on both sides. I have seen and stood on the sidelines while an estrogen war raged in my office. Estrogen wars are... testosterone wars, the men are shouting. Estrogen wars, they're silent. And the men stay as far
and Lammy,
away
which,
from it.
Which is more lethal?
The estrogen war.
I think you're right. No, you're absolutely
what happened
right.
Was, and this is, and then I'll listen. This is what started it, basically. The women were all, and again, it was a failure of leadership at the top. But basically, the women were all in on a project. Someone was on a mommy track. The mommy tracker decided, I'm taking 3-day weekends, my kids. And the other women said, we're not doing all her work. Huh. And they stopped talking.
All right.
And when they stopped talking, they stopped working together.
It's a really interesting story, Lonnie. Thank you very much.
And you're exactly right. I think that this is still a problem, and we saw this in roundtables we've done where... Because this is a new way of working, making sure that if you are working flexibly or a different sort of work schedule, that everybody understands you're pulling your weight is critical. And if you at all seem to be slacking off, it is not going to work. And there has to be good communication. You have to have managers on board. It's not always easy to pull off, but the key really is good communication. And it sounds as though... there was not at all good communication with your 3-day weekend worker.
I mean, I think the other thing that I would say is that this is a format that works you know, that what we're saying is that the whole workplace is shifting, that we have to stop looking at that clock and thinking of those three-day weekends in a sense, because people can, what a company like Best Buy is saying, for example, is, you know, we don't really care whether you work a three-day weekend or you work at 3 o'clock in the morning at Starbucks or you work at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the office, so long as you perform and you get your tasks done. And that's what's really exciting here, is that companies that are starting to think in a huge different strategic way about the way they're going to let their employees work and finding that, you know what, if we're all treated like adults, we will perform like adults.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC will continue in a minute with Katty Kay from the BBC, Claire Shipman from ABC, and their book, Womenomics, Write Your Own Rules for Success. We'll also talk about some things they've been saying about Newsweek and Oprah and coverage of autism and maybe some other stuff. So stay with us. Keep those calls coming. Hey, for some reason, Claire, Katty, mostly men have been calling in.
I love it, Brian.
So women, come on, show up for this. 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You know Claire Shipman, senior national correspondent for ABC News. Maybe you see her on the newscast or on ABC This Week on the roundtable sometimes. You may know Katty Kay from seeing her on Meet the Press roundtable fairly often. Chris Matthews, she actually works for BBC World News America as Washington correspondent. And together they have written a book called Womenomics, Write Your Own Rules for Success. And we'll go back to the phones in a minute. But Claire, some women will tell you that you're negotiating with the wrong party here, that what you said before about everybody wanting this in 15 years may not be true, and that it's not your boss but your husband where the real battle is. You know, when the husbands are willing to do half the child care, then the workplace will magically grow more flexible.
You know, we have both experienced in our own lives that gone through that phase, if you will, of thinking, well, are we doing more and shouldn't things be even, and having that sort of frustration. And you know what? Our book is basically, the advice we give is you've got to put that aside. This is not about figuring out how to make things, quote unquote, equal in a relationship, because what we realized, again, starting from the premise that most men and women want different things, and we again make the radical assumption that part of this is chemically and biologically driven, that I realized I want the time with my kids. I you know, it would be great if my husband wanted to be home with the kids, but that's not going to make me want to be with them any less. And once I let go of all of that, boy, did our marriage get better.
You're from Europe, Katty. You've lived in the Middle East. You've lived in Zimbabwe. Different cultures have different set points on this. Maybe it takes a Scandinavian legal model where the husbands have to take some of the time off, otherwise the family loses it, in order to start to equalize this, because women are different. So, you know, the men and women are going to want different things, as Claire says.
I mean, what I would say is that when I speak to my friends in Europe, in Britain, and in France, our concerns and our struggles as working mothers are identical. We have the same stories, the same issues dealing with guilt, or the same issues dealing with kind of micromanaging and horrible control freakishness, and are we managing to do everything and probably feeling like we're not doing any of it well enough. But definitely different legal and social models make a huge difference. And you do have a system in Scandinavia which is less to do with the husbands in a way, but more to do with the social welfare network, that you have great preschools, you have childcare that is free, the education is free, and that makes it easier for people to carry on working. You pay much higher taxes, of course, that's the price. But I know that I have friends who live in Sweden, and she's an artist. She's had 5 kids. And I remember saying to Anna, you know, how have you done this? You've always worked as an artist, which doesn't pay very much, and you've had 5 kids. And she said, well, I could never have done it in America.
Debbie in Huntington, you're on WNYC with Claire Shipman and Katty Kay.
A woman!
Debbie, yes, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry for 20 years, and I have to say that working for a female manager is much more difficult than working for a male, because in my opinion, the women who are willing to do what's required to move up the ladder tend to be the workaholics, the type A personalities who are going to prove it to the world that they are better than the man manager. And you're getting emails at 3 a.m. and they want you out at 6 o'clock in the morning to do this, and they're just nonstop workaholics, and they have the highest people leaving because they can't work for them.
Whereas
the men are much more appreciative of what you're doing and understanding.
I think you're it's so interesting because what you're touching on a number of things. I think you're right. First of all, that the women who have sort of broken through a ceiling, gotten to a senior manager level, in that generation probably have had to pay a price for that and have done it at maybe at the expense of free time with their kids, have had to work twice as hard. And there are a lot of women in that generation who think then that everybody should have to work the same way. It's really interesting. We interviewed a female executive in her mid-50s last week for Good Morning America who was reformed. She said, I was so mean when the women working for me had children. There was one sitting right next to her. She said she had to quit this young woman whom she loved, but they couldn't make it work. A few years later, she realized, I need her back. And her whole mentality is transformed. But that doesn't happen very often. I think you're going to see a generational shift and that will slowly change. But the other thing you talk about is a lot of the habits in our book that we say to have a life women need to get rid of, which is that perfectionism. And that, I mean, it sounds like, you know, if you're working for a woman, it sounds like she's being, yeah, exactly, a control freak, perfectionist, and isn't really able to see the big picture.
Often the case when somebody feels they have something more to prove because they may be undervalued,
right,
underestimated.
And, you know, some of this is about defining what you want in your life, Debbie. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of our book, we're looking at women thinking, when I get to 80, do I want to look back and think, I did those 60-hour weeks, I had all those vacations that never got taken, dashed to daycare closing time, or do I want to have had more balance in my life? And if that means more time with our kids, and maybe it means that our career does take a slightly slower path for a while, and then we can dial it back up again when the kids are older. Isn't that actually a model that, in the end, is going to mean more to us? And some people don't, you know, make different choices, but we have to be very clear about what we want and tune out those bosses, tune out those colleagues, tune out all that water cooler chat about she's lost her ambition, and realize that we are doing what we want to do.
Here's another new study. This is from a Business Week article. The motherhood penalty. Working moms face a pay gap versus childless peers. And it says, well, study after study focuses on the gender gap in wages. The pay gap between mothers and childless women is actually bigger than the pay gap between women and men, according to sociologist Sherry Correll. And their study, let's see, where's their study? It's called Getting a Job, Is There a Motherhood Penalty? And I think Marianne in Croton-on-Hudson has something to say about this. Marianne?
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I want you to know that I work in a school now, and I worked overseas in Africa and in Asia in different schools. And in doing my master's in education, I spoke to male teachers, African male teachers, and they spoke of having changed completely how they spoke to parents when doing parent-teacher conferences once they had children. And they knew what it was like to have children and have to go to those same kinds of interactions and hear what it was like to have a teacher say, well, your child isn't doing so well. And in the school that I work in now, there's certainly the same kind of difference between people who have had children and people who haven't had children, men and women.
Right.
There is a major change in orientation.
Marianne, thank you.
I think that's true, Marianne. And while our book is not primarily or only for women who have children, having children is often the driving force when women want to work differently. It's what often gives us that push. And I think that study is interesting because I think what that reflects is that women who have children and maybe feel they've been getting special dispensation at work to work a little more flexibly, even if it's unofficial, probably are less inclined to push for raises or to push for the same amount of money because they feel, well, maybe I'm already getting a favor. And I think what we're saying now is we're trying to help women understand this isn't a favor. You're still valuable whether you have children or not, and flexibility doesn't have to be something you literally have to pay for.
Right, and you're still valuable whether you're working a 3-day week or whether you're working a 5-day week, whether you're working full-time or part-time. And we think that often women can do full-time jobs but actually squeeze them into fewer hours because I don't know anyone more efficient than a working mother. And we change the pattern the way we work the moment we have kids.
Here's that study. More on that study. It says using fake resumes for two equally qualified candidates, one childless, one a mom, the researchers found that the mother was 100% less likely to be hired when she applied for a position. Mothers were consistently ranked as less competent and less committed than non-moms. They were also offered $11,000 a year less pay on average than an equally qualified childless candidate.
But here is the good news for women and for mothers, and actually, you know, probably for parents of all sorts, but there is a talent shortage looming in America, and women are better educated than men. We have more degrees, we have more postgraduate degrees, and companies are going to be looking to women and to looking to our skills and to our education and realizing they need to keep us. And if the cost of keeping us is allowing us to work more flexibly, that's the kind of model they're going to have to follow. And when they find that actually allowing us to work more flexibly and have more control over our time increases productivity, it doesn't diminish the way we do our job. We do our jobs better if we're allowed to do that, because we are going to sneak out the door to our child's parent, to our child's play at school anyway. But imagine your employer says to you, you know what? You can go. There's no penalty. There's no stigma for you going to that play. Rather than feeling resentful because you had to sneak out the back door, you're going to feel grateful. You're going to put the extra time and effort into your company. You're going to feel more committed to your employer. It's a great win-win for companies that are brave enough and bold enough to work these new ways.
Katty Kay and Claire Shipman, authors of Womenomics, Write Your Own Rules for Success, from our webpage. People writing in, all you need to do is walk into the pink collar industry of nonprofits to see the real leadership and successes of women. Someone else, can social and political equality for women be achieved if men do not become equal as parents at home? We talked about that before. Someone else, baby boomer era women must take the responsibility for making workplaces better for younger women. Mm-hmm. In my decade of work experience, that generation of women are less flexible and helpful to new mothers in the workplace. You're nodding.
Well, I think that's what the caller talked about earlier. It's true. Our generation, which is, you know, I'm at the tail end of baby boomers, but so baby boomers are the people who also broke through the glass ceiling. But it's true. It's like, you know, the doctors who say, well, everybody went through that horrible training to be an intern and a resident, so I should have to do, you know, everyone should have to do the same thing. And I think that's an attitude that women have to change. We should all want to make the workplace better for our children and for the people coming up.
Katty, you talked about all this new power that women in the workplace should be experiencing. Someone writes in, it's all well and good for people with elitist jobs like broadcasting to set their own conditions, but in this era of rising unemployment, ordinary folk dare not upset the jobs apple cart.
Right. I mean, you know, when we set out to write this book, we thought this is not going to be a useful book to women we know and to women all across America if it's just about Claire and I, because it's true. To some extent, we have a lot of power. We've risen up. We have certainly public profiles, although I would argue as well that, you know, broadcasting, as you know, Brian, is not an industry where it's very easy to carve out flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
You are measured by how much time you spend on air. And if you start saying, we want to be on air a bit less, you very quickly your bosses start saying, oh, you haven't got the ambition to rise to the top. But what we did in the book was we interviewed women from right across America in totally different positions, industries, and different levels. We are talking about professional women, women with college degrees. And listen, if you are poor in New York City or you are poor in New Delhi, you have fewer choices than women with an education and with college degrees. Absolutely. But we spoke to a mechanical engineer in Detroit. We have spoken to accountants in Florida. We have spoken to somebody who works in auto insurance in Plano, Texas. Women all across America in different companies who have started to carve out, either by themselves or with the cooperation of their companies, careers that are more flexible and allow them more time. And on that recessionary point, I think it's absolutely critical, because when we were writing the book, of course, we watched the economy tank and we thought, oh my goodness, how is this going to affect our thesis? And we went back to the companies we interviewed and they said, you know what, this is a really good time to start asking for a more flexible schedule, because companies can't afford that pay rise. They can't afford that bonus at the moment. So they are looking for creative ways to retain good talent.
Like time. Deborah in South Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was just going to kind of offer a counterweight to this whole argument. I have had one of those jobs where I could work remotely at times and had the technology to do so, and ostensibly the job was set up to a degree. Obviously, there are boundaries where, you know, as long as you got your tasks done, blah, blah, blah. Sounds great for a working mom. I have 2 9-year-olds. But really what that became was an excuse for me to be tethered to the job and to my employer and on call more or less 24/7. So some of these seemingly flexible arrangements and mom or family-friendly arrangements are honestly just the opposite. I am now not working for that firm any longer. But it got to the point where my kids were like, I am never working in business. This is horrible.
I know. Well, I have to tell you that my son the other day, you know, as I was BlackBerrying somebody again, just said, Mom, if you don't stop typing on that, you have to answer my question. I've asked you the same thing three times. So you're right. You have to be able to set limits whichever way you go. And I think that part of the problem with this new sort of freedom you can get that is enabled by technology is that the technology can also be your jailer. And I think that is where you need to set limits for yourself and your employer. And I think there's no question employers can try to abuse the situation.
Deborah, thank you very much. A few minutes left with Katty Kay from the BBC, Claire Shipman from ABC, and their new book, Womenomics. And I want to touch a couple of other things in our last few minutes. Your blog post on womenomics.com on the Newsweek cover photo of Oprah Winfrey. It's very interesting. And it's not just about the portrayal of Oprah's face, but also about the magazine's treatment of autism and the childhood immunization debate. What was important there to you?
Well, I wrote that I was just very infuriated by that Newsweek article. I didn't really set out to rant back, but I have done a lot of coverage for Good Morning America on the autism issue and also some of the bioidentical hormone issue and Suzanne Summers. And I was just struck by how bad Newsweek's case was. They were essentially saying Oprah's crazy and she has crazy people on and none of the stuff that they're talking about makes sense. It's just not true. I mean, they didn't, the hormone debate and bioidentical hormone debate is a real debate. And a lot of very credible doctors think that those hormones are more effective than synthetic hormones. And the fact that Newsweek didn't even mention that synthetic hormones are sold by drug companies and who push them because they can patent them, I thought was odd.
You can't patent the bioidentical hormones.
Exactly. And then on the autism debate, I mean,
ABC tried to kill a story of yours on autism, didn't they?
Well, it wasn't ABC really as much as it was getting a lot of blowback from the established medical community. And ABC, you know, we have a very rigorous approval process for what goes on the air, especially about medical things, which I'm glad for, and it ultimately passed the test. But it was not easy because we got so much pressure from the established medical community. We were simply trying to make the case with some doctors that doing MRIs and EEGs can be helpful in diagnosing autism, but that was created such an uproar.
Diagnosing the brain instead of the behavior.
Looking at the brain, exactly, which does make a lot of sense. And there are reasons for it because often these kids have seizure disorder, which you can't see otherwise. But in the course of that reporting, it was clear to me from talking to a number of specialists, including one at Harvard, that nobody has ruled out that immunizations are playing some role in a small number of cases. There are just too many people saying that their child is immunized and the next day there's a change. Not that all autism is.
Though there's no evidence establishing the link.
There is no evidence, but that's the tricky part, that there's no evidence, but that doesn't mean there isn't a link. And to suggest that Jenny McCarthy or Oprah is crazy just seemed over the top to me.
And Katty, I saw your piece on Daily Beast complaining that White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs engages in too much sports talk before and during White House press briefings, especially baseball banter. What's that like for you?
Well, as somebody that really can't make out one end of a baseball bat from another, this is always infuriating. But it was more that there is a boys' club out there. In green rooms and in press briefing rooms. And I've just found it was particularly insidious when it goes into the press briefing rooms. There are women who love sports, but there are a greater number of men who love sports. And I just happened to notice that when I was in the green rooms going on these, you know, Sunday morning talk shows or something, the conversation would be about politics and everyone would be chipping in, and then it would get to sports. And you know what happened? The women fell silent.
What's the percentage of women in that room, the White House briefing room, usually when he does that?
I'm just wondering. I think it's probably about 50-50 now.
Really?
It's number of women covering the White House has definitely increased, and I would say it's about half and half.
And
I spoke to women who cover – I don't actually cover the White House every day. I watch the briefing usually, and I've spoken to a couple of women from different networks and papers who are there. And I said, well, you know, how do you feel? And they said, it's true. We just kind of feel slightly excluded from this conversation because it doesn't come as naturally to us. It feels a little bit like the old boys club.
And so I'm curious, if women ran the press briefings, what kind of banter do you think would replace the sports talk?
We'd be talking
fashion.
About work-life balance. important issues.
Okay, sorry. I was off topic.
Shoes.
We'd be talking about the power of women in the marketplace.
And Claire Caddy quotes you in that piece saying it's hard to sit next to George Will using baseball analogies all the time on the ABC This Week roundtable.
I feel such pressure, especially when, for example, there's a baseball strike on or we have to talk about drugs and baseball. And I think, I'm next to George Will today. What am I going to say? I usually actually just want to take a pass.
I always feel like the idiot who's going to use the wrong term for the wrong sport and completely show up how little I know about this.
Tell the quarterback hit a home run, right?
Something.
One last thing then, Claire. Why does George Will always get the first question on the round table? Is that in his contract?
I don't know that it's in his contract, but he is, it must be said, the regular on the round table. He's on every week. So I think it's only fair that he gets the first question. A lot of people watch the roundtable to listen to George Will.
Maybe, but maybe it's a kind of contractual conservative bias, you know? The right winger always gets first crack Obama as a matter of contract.
You know, ABC is constantly accused of conservative bias. You're right. I'd love to see that, right?
And that's where we will leave it with Claire Shipman, who is senior national correspondent for ABC News. And Caddy Kay, who is Washington correspondent for BBC World News America.
Oh, we're at Barnes & Noble
tonight, Brian. Oh, you are? Go ahead. Tell us where.
We have a reading at Barnes & Noble tonight. Upper West Side?
Broadway and 81st, we think.
What time?
7 o'clock.
All right. To talk about and read and sign Womenomics, Write Your Own Rules for Success. Thank you very much for all this time.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.